Okay. Let's see from over here. So,
what's that? People coming up, so wait a minute, and people walking up the steps. Tisha B'Av being the day of the national Jewish mourning, in the past years I've always spoken this time slot about a particular tragedy that befell the Jewish people in one epoch or another. I felt that this year I'll talk about the anti-Semitism in general. Rather than focus on one particular era, one particular event, we'll touch on numerous events. Let me state at the outset that the subject of anti-Semitism could be at least a semester or two. So in 1 hour or so, you know, there's a limit to what we can actually touch upon. I'll do my best. And every one of these events also could be the subject of a lot of discussion, a lot of books. I mean, I have here a book called Christian Antisemitism, History of Hate, which is, it's a 500 pages or so. And it's one of many. There are many different types of books that are written on this subject. I'd just like to go through some general things, which I think maybe will give us some understanding of this unusual philosophy and this unusual way of behaving, unusual way of acting. I have a book here called History and Hate, which is edited by Professor David Berger, who lives in the neighborhood, professor of the history, right now the dean of Bernard Revel Graduate School. And he writes in the beginning of his this book, which is somebody just edited a compilation of different articles. He writes, "We shall never fully understand anti-Semitism. Deep-rooted, complex, endlessly persistent, constantly changing yet remaining the same, it is a phenomenon that stands at the intersection of history, sociology, economics, political science, religion, and psychology. But it is often the most elusive phenomena that are the most intriguing. And here, fascination and profound historical significance merge to make the subject a central challenge for Jewish historians, and I would add to Jewish non-historians, even people looking to understand. Where exactly does anti-Semitism begin? Well, Soloveitchik once explained that the first sort of public singling out of Jews as a people is in Mitzrayim, in Paro's situation. They pointed to the fact at the beginning of Parsha Shmos, and I won't fish above so we don't learn Torah, but this is relevant to our discussion. The pasuk says, "Ve'ela Shmos b'nei Yisrael haboim Mitzrayim." Mitzrayim. These are the names of the Jews, haboim Mitzrayim. But as we know, the Jews, by the time this pasuk is recorded, had already been in Mitzrayim for some time. Why haboim Mitzrayim in the present sense? Present tense. Of Soloveitchik explained, because that is one methodology of anti-Semitism. The Jews just got here. They're not part of our society. They're not part of our country. They're just arriving now. They're newcomers. Then it has the list. And of course, there's the names. And the Torah says, by the new king who did not remember the good things that Yosef accomplished on behalf of the whole country, forgot about it. I think the dispute is, remember, it was the same king who just forgot. It was the new king, whoever it was. But this too, the Rav said, is a methodology of anti-Semitism to forget past Jewish contributions to this very land, whatever the land happens to be. Right? It's new. They just got here, and we ignore and dismiss whatever good they might have done. By Omer Amo, Pharaoh said to his nation, "Hinei am b'nei Yisrael rav atzum mimenu." The Jewish people are becoming more populous than we are. What do you mean they're becoming more popular? They're part of us, aren't they? The Jewish people lived in Mitzrayim. And that's another methodology of anti-Semitism. Namely, that you view the Jew as other. They're not part of us. Right? There's us and there's them. Rav atzum mimenu. They are becoming more populous than we. Not one nation, there's somebody else. Let's outwit them. There might be a war. They'll join the other side. Why would they do that? The Jews were living in Mitzrayim and were reasonably comfortable and reasonably successful. They lived in Eretz Goshen. Things had worked out of the Yosef and the brothers. Why would there be any assumption that if there were to be a war, a third party would attack from outside, that the Jews in Osafgam, who also are there, they'll join the enemy. But why? No, they won't. Jews are loyal. Another methodology of anti-Semitism. Jews, they're not really loyal to our country. They're going to join up with the enemy. They have to overthrow it. And therefore, it starts out, they buy us some Sari Nisim, they have to build buildings, they labor, cheap labor, etc. And eventually, you know, you're throwing the poison into the water. The Rav said that that's, you know, sort of typical of the anti-Semitic approach to classify the Jews as newcomers, not really part of our land. There are many of them. They're not really part of us. They're not on our side. They'll join our enemies. You say these things, it sinks in. The idea, he said, that even Paro, who, you know, doesn't win any prizes for being a good guy, even Paro could not possibly have convinced all of the Egyptians in one shot, one fine morning, to say, let's enslave the Jews. Wouldn't it work? But slowly, you chip away, So that's how anti-Semitism works. You set up certain things, you popularize certain things in the press, in the media, whatever the press media equivalent is in that particular society. You say things about the Jews, you get people to believe it, and eventually you can get them to do all kinds of things, which, first glance, they never think about doing. One point that Dr. Berger mentions here in terms of a definition, he says as follows. He says, essentially anti-Semitism means either of the following. One, hostility towards Jews as a group, which results from no legitimate cause or greatly exceeds any reasonable ethical response to genuine provocation. Now, there's no real reason, or even if there is some reason, but the response is much harsher and the response is much more exaggerated. But two, a pejorative perception of Jewish physical or moral traits, which is either utterly groundless or the result of irrational generalization and exaggeration. That's, I think, a pretty good definition of the Ismail's comma. And so, if we look through history, we can probably divide or come upon anti-Semitic conduct falling into 7 or 8 or 9 different categories over the centuries, changing from time to time. It doesn't mean that only this type existed in that period of time, only that type existed in this period of time, but overall, certain periods of time were characterized by certain different types of anti-Semitism. The Gemara actually has an interesting comment, not that argument actually, but a Chazal, that says, you know where hatred of Jews comes from? It comes from Har Sinai. Har Sinai is called Har Sinai, not Sinai. And the Gemara wonders, Chazal, the Medrash says, where did the Hasidim call Har Sinai? It's called Har Chorev, not Chorev. We come upon it and say, for sure, it's called Har Chorev. Where does the name Sinai come from? So it's a play on words. And Sinai comes from the word Sina, hatred. Because Misham, Yorah the Sinai, because from there, hatred came. Now you'll wonder that the Sinai is with a Sana, and Sinai is with a Sin. And that's true, but by the way, in older Hebrew, it's sometimes interchangeable. Some of you may recall, you can look it up after Tisha B'Av in Keladon, that we say on Shabbos, and Shachar's after Baruch Hu, the Keladon, so it's an alphabetical acrostic. And the Samach Sinza is Mechim to say something, Sin. So Samach and Sin can be interchangeable, even with words, besides that, you don't play on words. But okay. In what sense is Sinai the origin of Sima? Well, I mentioned this in the past in my shul. Sometimes you have a situation where you dislike somebody because you think he or she is trying to show you up. And it makes you feel guilty. It makes you feel bad. This is this Chazal. I'm not saying it applies all the time. But Chazal meant this as follows. We know we have a tradition that Hashem, when Hashem is Sinai, says that Hashem offered the Torah to all the other nations. And they all said, well, what does it say? So one of the nations told them, it says you're not allowed to steal. And they said, no, we can't do it like that. Which, by the way, is an honest response. The moral code is too much for us. It's a good answer. That's them telling the truth. And went to a different nation, what does it say? It says this. We can't live like that. And so they all refused the Torah. Until it was presented to the Jewish people, okay, we'll do it. Right? So I give an example in my teaching background. So imagine the teacher gives an assignment, and the teacher says, you know, you have to read for homework, or you have to do 25 problems. And the kids, the class is screaming, oh, it's too much. And this one kid says, no problem.
So you want to smack that kid? Right? I mean, everyone's saying, you know, it's impossible. It's impossible. There's one person. Fucking do it. But that's the B'nai Yisrael. That's Mishom Yerah the Sinaloa. Right? The old B'nai Yisrael, we can't do it. Oh, we'll do it. No problem. Okay, well, that creates a certain attitude. And according to this Chazal, that's a source, the notion of anti-Semitism, that the Jewish people are supposed to behave a certain way. And when they don't, so we hold it against them. And even if they do behave that way, they're showing us up. Many people remember, Israelis will remember years ago in the Lebanon War, so there were two refugee camps in Lebanon called Sabra and Shafiwa. Remember Sabra and Shafiwa? And Lebanon, you know, there's fighting between the Christians and the Muslims. And this camp was, these two camps were mass slaughters in these two camps. Okay, Christians and Muslims killing each other. Who got blamed for it? Israel. Because Israel was technically in military control of the area. And there was all kinds of inquiries around the whole thing. And I'm not saying they didn't share some of the blame. But you know, when in Africa and other places you have massacres of hundreds of thousands of people, or even in Syria today, who knows how many people have been killed, you hear barely a word about it. You know why? Because there's a certain prejudice. What's the prejudice? In Africa, what do you expect of them? No one says that. No one says that. But solidly, okay, so these two warring tribes, someone in the middle of Africa, they killed, you know, 10,000 people are killed, okay. But when Jews do it, or Jews are involved, there's another standard, because Jews aren't supposed to behave that way. Against a certain prejudice, but that's, I think, what this Chazal is. But I'd just like to look at some periods in history and understand the anti-Semitism of those periods of history. First, I outline them and go through some details. During the time, the Hellenistic period, okay, which is you know, before the Churban, the second Beis Hamikdash, Hanukkah, and so on. So the earliest reference to Jews in Hellenistic literature, recorded history, to the Greeks and so on, it was generally positive. Okay, however, there are objections raised because of refusal to intermarry. Our Jews will not marry anybody else but Jews. So there's an air of superiority. We're not good enough for you. Okay. Refusal to accept their god or gods. Worship many gods. Jews didn't accept their gods. So once again, our religion, our way of life is not good enough for you. Okay. Dietary restriction. Can't eat with us. All kinds of rules. Touch the wine and this and that and the next thing, which also people resent. Okay, and also, again, the notion of perhaps rebellion, right? The Jews are going to join against it. Of course, once Christianity arrives on the scene, that's the next epoch, the next period of history, once Christianity is on the scene, so then the hatred of Jews centers around rejection of Jesus, killing, Christ killing, and so on. The Christians did not invent anti-Semitism. The Christians did not invent hatred of the Jews, but the ground was fertile. The ground was there, and these accusations of killing, you know, deicide, of killing their god, and so on, was certainly something which reinforced that kind of feeling. In medieval Christian theology, again, each one of these topics is subject to discussion, so on, I'm really just trying to generalize. In medieval Christian theology, so there's a certain love-hate relationship between Jews and Christians. On the one hand, it's understood that Judaism, that the Torah, is the origin for the Christians as well. They refer to it as the Old Testament, but it's part of their religion as well. So they're spawned, so to speak, by the Jews. On the other hand, they are the witnesses, mentioned McKinnon this morning, to what happens when you don't accept their religion. So officially, the official policy is that you don't, you know, you leave the Jews alone and wander and to suffer, right, poverty and not having their own land, because that's the sign, that's the message, that's what happens to people who don't accept Jesus. See that? You leave the Jews in their despondent state and their downtrodden state because it's a witness to the truth of Christianity. Jewish suffering, as Christ killed himself, see, that's what they deserve. By the time of the High Middle Ages, or later, okay, so Christianity was stronger by itself, and not that there was less of the Christ-killing accusations and so on, but it was a different kind of thing, viewing Jews, so to speak, as aliens. Jews are different. Their behavior is different. They don't want to associate. Again, we saw that in Hellenistic times. So that became more prevalent in the High Middle Ages. Then after that, the later Middle Ages, so there's something that you refer to as demonology. Jews are the devil. Jews are the devil incarnate. Okay, plagues and wars are the fault of Jews. Okay, again, we'll go into detail these shortly.
Okay, ritual murder, blood libels. Jews do these all kinds of horrible things. Jewish doctors poison non-Jewish patients. Okay, they're of dubious humanity. The Jews are offspring of pigs. Okay, or the Jews result from the relationship between Adam and a demon, or from the excrement of the patriarchs and so on. All kinds of things you find in literature from that time. By the 18th century, Christianity was less important to the Christians, okay, religious Christianity, and something else came up, and that is that the Jews are socially different. Jews were identified with whatever movement you were against. Okay, so it led to contradictions. On the one hand, Jews controlled all the money. Jews are the Rothschilds and so on. On the other hand, Jews are paupers, beggars, and, you know, live in extreme poverty. Okay, on the one hand, Jews are the big capitalist business. On the other hand, Jews support communists, right? The anti-capitalism. On the one hand, Jews are limited in their thinking. They are bound by old traditions and religious law. On the other hand, Jews think too freely. They're too open-minded, right? On one hand, the Jews are foolish. They have, again, they believe in superstitions. On the other hand, they're evil geniuses. It didn't matter. You had these contradictory presentations depending on where your particular angle was. A little later than that, with the rise of nationalism and identifying with country, so what nationalism demanded was a sort of unswerving, inviolate patriotism and loyalty to the country. And Jews were viewed as being the old state within a state, dual loyalty. I'm sure you've heard many of these phrases. I'm just trying to put them all together and see that there's a different aspects or different types of anti-Semitism. I stress again, it's not that one thing exists and the other time. Just overall, these eras were characterized more than one by one than the other. But the idea of nationalism, that Jews, you know, don't belong in our country, and whether a Frenchman is going to get German citizenship or a German is going to get Italian citizenship. They're not part of us. They're not part of our country. Jews tried, but the problem is, and again with the assimilation, with the movements of the reform and so on, the more Jews tried to become part of the culture around them, so, you know, they tried to act like Christians. So they, on the one hand, okay, so good, we'll be just like you. But then, so the question is, so why don't you convert it? You know, it became, the more Jews tried to act like Christians, the more it was a question, so why did the Taka become Christian? And therefore, to some, Jewish acculturation was a threat. It's interesting, the Beis HaLevi, the great grandfather of Soloveitchik, says, it's an interesting essay, and he says that, it's strange, you have Psukim again in Parsha Shmos, that the Egyptians persecuted the Jews, and suddenly the Jews on the Rebbe Mitzrayim, they asked the Egyptians for kesef and zav and gold and silver, and they gave it to them willingly. Sure, help yourself. You know, what changed? And he has a whole thesis that the Jews, who were careful about the mitzvah of Bismillah and so forth when they were, they were physically, the men were physically different, and that the Egyptians had no problem with. It's when the Jews abandoned that mitzvah, he brings Midrashim again, not the time of Israel, but he brings Midrashim to demonstrate that when the Jews abandoned mitzvahs and tried to be like the Egyptians, that's when the Egyptians resented them. Because they're not us, and they're trying to be like us, they're wannabes. But as long as they, but then when they went back again, after, you know, the time of the giving of the first mitzvah, the Karmel Pesach and so on, and the Chodesh Elohim, so then, okay, then we can live in peace with them. Interesting idea. Of course, by the 20th century, things shifted to a different type of anti-Semitism, away from social anti-Semitism to racial anti-Semitism. You're all familiar, you know, with Hitler's presentations of different races and so on. There were different races within among Europeans. Okay, I just came back here for the 9 days in Poland. You know, the Poles were considered the lowest, the human beings, but they're the lowest form of human beings. They're labor, they're cheap labor. The Jews didn't even make the list of human beings, right? And that was the breakdown. Okay, so that's a racial anti-Semitism. The Jews were a different race. And again, they're religiously deviant, they're a different race, and therefore, you know, it's okay to eliminate them. The way to eliminate, eliminate an animal, you know, the pesky mosquito. So you can eliminate the Jew also. And in more contemporary times, anti-Semitism revolves around Israel, around Zionism. You remember 1975, the United Nations decision that Zionism is racism, and so on. So a lot of contemporary anti-Semitism revolves around Eretz Yisrael and, you know, the Palestinian cause and that. So this is an overview of 8 or 9 different types of anti-Semitism. I'd like to look at a few examples of each in each of these cases in the time that we have. quote some sources and so on. The in terms of the ancient world, as I mentioned before, so the ancient world, the Jews were loyal to Alexander the Great, who was the great, you know, founder of the Greek Empire and so on. His father, Philip Macedonius, Alexander the Great followed. And the writings of Josephus, we find that the Jews were trusted. Jews were involved in the military. I'm reading now from an article in this book. This is by Professor Louis Feldman, Zohar Lavacha, who was a professor of classics in the university for many years, and one of the biggest experts on that period of time. Professor Feldman wrote, apparently the Jews of Egypt retained their religious time of Alexander the Great. He writes, Jews of Egypt retained their religious ties to their brethren in the land of Israel, and it's led to recurrent charge, so often found against Jews throughout the ages, that divided loyalties made them less than exemplary citizens of the countries which they happened to reside in. Apion, in accordance with the ancient view that participation in the civic religion was an indication of good citizenship, asked why, if the Jews were good citizens, they did not worship the same gods as the Alexandrians. And he proceeded to accuse the Jews of fostering sedition while they were notorious concert one with the other. In other words, this charge of double loyalty may have been fostered by various incidents. And he has a couple of stories where, again, different individual Jews may have done X, Y, and Z. So that became typical of the entire Jewish people. That rings a bell to us from the charge that Haman made, right? One fellow doesn't bow down to him. Mordechai, that's typical of all the Jews. Haman didn't want this to eliminate Mordechai, but rather he wanted to eliminate all the Jewish people. Why? Okay, one guy didn't bow down to him. Probably the other Jews that did. Okay, so, but nevertheless, that's the same thing that we see in this instance. Now, but as I said, in terms of what Professor Feldman divides between, the government attitude, which generally Jews were trusted, because their government, often consisted of people who were more intellectually savvy and who understood better who they could trust and so on. And Jews were generally often very trusted by the leaders and were given positions, which, of course, in terms of the masses, only encouraged more jealousy and more hatred. Why are the Jews in these high positions, as we just read from Appian? So in terms of the government, there was a certain trust of Jews, that, again, not all the time. We know that in the Roman times, the persecution of Jews was promulgated by the government. But again, in upper class circles, often Jews were trusted, okay, in terms of government positions. However, in terms of the masses, it was a different thing altogether. In the year 38, see, we think of pogroms. You ask the average person, about a pogrom, he's going to think of some town in Poland or Hungary. However, there were pogroms against the Jews as far back as 38, the year 38 of the Common Era. The Second Base Mikdash was still standing. Okay, there was a pogrom in the city of Alexandria. Okay, and there was a riot. The Jews were blamed for a riot. Again, very similar to things. Again, this is where the Beis HaMikdash was still standing. Okay, that's how long ago we're talking. And there was a riot. And Jews and non-Jews were fighting in the streets. Okay, it started because the Roman emperor at the time was Caligula. Some of you may remember that Caligula was known as Caligula the Mad. Okay, so part of his madness was he insisted that everybody in his empire should worship him as a god. The Jews weren't that excited about that. So there was a revolution. Okay, and the riots in the streets, and of course the Jews were blamed for it, and some people tried to stop it, but the mobs went out. Again, you can see the parallels. And similarly, when year 66, which again right before the Qurban, there was another riot. So again, pogroms were not limited to more modern times. And Professor Feldman's article, he writes, a mob seized three Jews with the intention of burning them alive. The whole Jewish community rose to their rescue, and a riot resulted. The riot was put down ruthlessly by the Roman governor, Tiberius Julius Alexander, an apostate Jew, whose troop reportedly killed 50,000 Jews. Okay, near 66 in Alexandria. Right? Now, the fact that the Romans were not without casualties seemed to indicate that some Jews were armed and so on and so forth, but due to the mob, the intensity of the hatred, okay, he writes, as for the mob itself, so intense was its hatred that considerable effort was required to tear the attackers away from beating the corpses. Okay, this is they think they're still standing. So it's just a picture of what took place in terms of the masses. The the war that ended with the destruction of the Beis Hamikdash, Josephus writes as follows. While the Holy House, the Beis Hamikdash, was on fire, everything was plundered, and 10,000 of those who were caught were slain. Nor was there a commiseration of any age or any reverence of gravity, but children, old men, profane persons, priests, were all slain in the same manner. This is Josephus writing about the period before them. The flame was also carried a long way, made an echo together with the groans of those who were slain, because this hill was high, and the works of the temple were very great, one would have thought that the whole city had been on fire. Nor can one imagine anything either greater or more terrible than this noise, for there was at once a shout of the Roman legions who were marching all together, and a sad clamor of the seditious who were now surrounded with fire and swords. Again, this is a picture of the Churban. Was that directly anti-Semitic? Well, again, it depends on our definition of the term. We know that there were later on Xerus, Hadrianic persecution, and so on. But that's a picture of what's going on in early history, okay, around the time of the beginning of Christianity, the Churban HaBayis. Five different things, again, the Jews were subjected to accusations, hatred of mankind, okay, easily persuaded, and not being rigorously intelligent, okay, that they were poor, beggars, that they had dual loyalties, and also Jews were accused of proselytizing, which did not make the locals feel good either. So that's from that period of time. And moving a little bit further, okay, in the era that followed, okay, the Roman period and so on, when Christianity was on the rise, so we find a gentleman, I don't know if it's a gentleman or not, a fellow by the name of John Chrysostom, later St. John Chrysostom, who wrote as follows. How can Christians have the slightest converse with Jews, the most miserable of all men? He went on to describe Jews as inveterate murderers, destroyers, men possessed by the devil. To him, the synagogue was a place of shame and ridicule, the domicile of the devil. Indeed, he told his congregation that Jews worship the devil with rites that are criminal and impure, and the synagogue was an assembly of criminals, a den of thieves, and a cavern of devils. Okay, why do you hate the Jews? Because of their odious assassination of Jesus. And his view, that rejection and the dispersal of Jews, the work of God. And so that's, again, a typical example of anti-Semitism from the early Christian period. Another interesting quote from the same fellow. Where Christ killers gather, the cross is ridiculed. God blasphemed, the Father unacknowledged, the Son insulted, the grace of the Spirit rejected. If the Jewish rites are holy and venerable, then our way of life must be false. But if our way is true, as indeed it is, then theirs is fraudulent. I'm not speaking of the scriptures, far from it, for they lead one to Christ. I'm speaking of their present impiety and madness. So basically, you appeal to the Christians and say, well, it's one way or the other. Either Judaism is right, or we're right. So if we're right, and we are, as they said, then they've got to be wrong. So how can we ever have any kind of dialogue? How can we ever have any kind of relationship? Now, this is in the Christian world. You should remember that not all Jews lived in the Christian world. Jews lived in the Muslim world as well. And we're accustomed to thinking, not without the cause, that Jews suffered less living in Arab countries and Muslim countries. And certainly in terms of persecution, while there were persecutions, no doubt, that is true. But it didn't mean that the Jews were liked or respected any greater way. Okay, Jews had the status of what's called Dhimmi, D-H-I-M-M-I, which means that they were in effect second-class citizens. All right, Jews had to agree. Certainly, we shall not build in our cities any buildings that are bigger than the Muslims and so on. We shall hold public religious ceremonies. We're not going to proselytize anyone. We shall not prevent any of our relatives from embracing Islam if they so desire. We shall show deference to the Muslims and shall rise from our seats when they wish to sit down. We shall not seek to resemble the Muslims in any way, regard to their dress, for example, with the turban, sandals, or the parting of the hair in the Arab fashion. We shall not speak as they do, nor shall we adopt their names. We shall not ride on saddles. We shall not wear swords or bear weapons of any kind, or even carry them with us. Again, we shall not take any slaves belonging to the Muslims. We shall not build our homes larger than theirs. Okay. So again, you have here in the Muslim period an example of treating Jews as second-class citizens. The next era, the era of the Crusades. Those who recited the Kinnis this morning know there are several Kinnis that focus on the Crusades. The Crusades was the call of the Pope, November 1095, and the First Crusade, 1096. The Pope, according to one account, told the group in France, "Let none of your possessions detain you, no solitude for your family affairs, since this land which you inhabit shut on all sides by the sea and heard about a mountain peak, that's the Alps and so on. It's too narrow for a large population. Pick yourself up, go to Jerusalem and so on, where according to our belief, that's where Jesus is between his death and his resurrection, and take over the land from the Muslims. This is a side point I mentioned this morning. It occurred to me, and I don't remember where I saw this, maybe somebody knows, that you know all these kenos relating to the to the Crusades. As horrible as the Crusades were, in a certain sense, you have to give them credit, because in terms of what they were trying to accomplish, the Pope made it an announcement, we should all go to the Holy Land and liberate the Holy Land from the Muslims who occupied it. And many people did. They left their homes and so on. Not that many Jews left their homes to go live in Eretz Yisrael. They got liberated, which is to go live there. So it was a little bit of a dig, with the Jews. But in any event, we don't have to document the period of the Crusades. We talked about it before. But again, it was a period where on their way, they went ahead and attacked the Jews. Now, some Christian leaders, St. Bernard of Clairvaux, for example, writes as follows. The Jews are not to be persecuted, killed, or even put to flight. The Jews are for us the living words of Scripture, for they remind us always of what our Lord suffered. They are all dispersed. They are dispersed all over the world, that by explaining their crime, they may be everywhere, the living witnesses of our redemption. The Jews are utterly wiped out. What will become of our hope for their promised salvation, their eventual conversion? So it wasn't obvious concern exactly that motivated his feeling that way, but he felt that, again, in terms of Christian theology, the Jews should be left alone. It was in the 1100s. Again, the first one is unclear when it was. But in the 1100s, the Jews now began to be accused of things like the blood libel. Okay, we know poisoning matzahs or poisoning other things with Christian blood. Okay, the Jews laid their blood-stained hands upon the innocent victim and have lifted him up from the ground, fastened him upon a cross, and they vied with one another to make an end of it. In doing these things, they were adding pang to pang, wound to wound, yet were not able to satisfy their heartless cruelty and the inborn hatred of the Christian name. Lo, after those many and great tortures, they inflicted a frightful world. They're describing one case, really fiction, of course, but describing one thing, one attack of a Christian person. They inflicted a frightful wound in his left side, reaching even to his heart. And as though to make an end of all, they extinguished his mortal life so far as in their power. And since many streams of blood were running down all parts of his body, then, to stop the blood and to wash and close the wound, they poured boiling water over him. These accusations of ritual murder, again, this were not new, but took on a life of its own, and it continued for many, many centuries. I heard from my father-in-law, the story, and I wanted to share this, that he heard of his grandfather. And his grandfather lived in Russia. And he said that one Seder night, they were having the Seder, remember the family was there, and they heard the thump on the front door, and they opened the door, and there was a dead Christian baby. And immediately, the helper Zeta, who was in charge of the house, immediately said, take the body and throw it into the fire. Had a fire burning, I'll tell you, it kept warm, right to the fireplace. And they threw it into the fire, and the body was burnt up. And about a couple hours later, the authorities came looking for the baby. And it was a plant, obviously. I heard this, and somebody heard it, and someone was there. That's the blood libel, which started way back when, but repeated itself, many, 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 many times. Another aspect of anti-Semitism was hatred of the Talmud. The Talmud was considered to be, they couldn't hate the Bible, because the Bible is part of their culture as well. The Talmud, however, that's the root of all the trouble. And this was promulgated by people like Nicholas Donner, who's an apostate Jew, okay? You can interpret things in the Talmud in a way to be negative, and you can interpret Talmud properly. You can interpret it in a way to be negative. So there are a lot of things that are in the Gemara which indicate why Jews are stubborn and why they don't listen to, they accept Jesus and so on and so forth. And this came to a head, one of the kinnis we said this morning, the famous Shalit Sukkot Ma'ish, composed by Ron Lundberg, where in the 1200s, 1236, they burned, actually 1242, I found it was done 1242, June 1242, more than 24 wagon loads of books, about 10,000 volumes, were taken to the square in Paris and burnt, ironically right near where the Notre Dame Church was burnt. So that's where this pyre took place, this great fire was destroying all these books of the Talmud, 24 wagon loads, some people have a tinnitus, some people fast on the Shabbos Parshas Chukas. Not to bother to observe nowadays, But look at Shahar, I say that some people fast on Erev Shabbos Pashas Sukkah and can arrange that event. And one of the kinnas, one of the last of the kinnas, you can look it up, number 41, on the list of the Yad Yaretz, so you can look it up and read the whole story there when you get home if you so desire. Again, so hate for the Talmud became something which was also characteristic of anti-Semitism. In the period following that, Jews were blamed for the Black Death, the plague, the bubonic plague, which wiped out huge swaths of population, including Jews, by the way. It's a myth to say the Jews were not killed. It could be the Jews were less affected because of requirements like the Kiddush Yadayim, requirements like washing after the bathroom, and so on, and so on. But it's incorrect. Absolutely factually incorrect that the Jews did not. Many, many Jews died in the Black Plague, as many, many Christians are, many, many more. We're talking about, you know, huge percentages of the population we wiped out by this plague, which, of course, they first didn't know what it was, what caused it, and so on. So what caused it? Well, the Jews are poisoning the wells. The Jews are poisoning the water supply. So it was, again, a convenient scapegoat. Just to give you a picture of what it was like in Europe, this is nothing to do with Jews, but this statement. Death went from one end of the earth to the other. Okay, on that side and on this side of the sea. It was greater among the Muslims than among the Christians in some areas. In some lands, everyone died, so no one was left. Ships were also found on the sea, laden with wares. The crew had all died. No one was guiding the ship. The ship simply floated ashore. Everyone on the boat was dead. Okay? The Bishop of Marseille in France and priests and monks and more than half all the people there died with them. In other kingdoms and cities, so many people perished that it would be horrible to describe. So this is a terrible tragedy, you know, the bubonic plague, which was spread by rats and insects and so on and so forth. But it was an excuse also to pin on Jews. Okay. Again, people look for a scapegoat. And here's the story. On February 9th, 1349, Strasbourg, which is a city in present-day France, St. Valentine's Day. Saturday, St. Valentine's Day, they burnt the Jews on a wooden platform in the cemetery. There were about 2,000 people. Well, we have images of the Holocaust, but this was in 1349. Many small children were taken out of the fire and baptized against the will of their fathers and mothers. Everything that was owed to the Jews was canceled. The Jews had to surrender all pledges and all notes they'd taken for debts. The council, however, took the cash that the Jews possessed and divided it among the working men proportionally. The money was indeed the thing that killed the Jews. If they had been poor, and if the feudal lords had not been in debt to them, they would not have been burnt. Okay, in other words, sometimes a kesef ganas hakol was money, economically driven, the chance to take Jewish money. I mentioned before that, I should mention one other thing, of course, you can't overlook the expulsion from Spain. Okay, the expulsion from Spain took place on Tisha B'Av in the year 1492. There is a description from no one else but the Abarbanel, okay, who was one of the Jews who left. The Abarbanel writes, I'm going to find it here. Yeah, Barbanel, who was a Spanish government official in addition to being important commentary on the Tanakh, writes as follows. In the end, they're left without strength 300,000 people on foot, from the youngest to the oldest, all at one time, from all the provinces that came to wherever they were able to go. Each pledged himself to God anew. Some went to Portugal and Navarre, which are close, but all they found there were more troubles and more darkness, looting, starvation, pestilence. Some traveled through the perilous ocean. Here, too, God's hand was against them. And many were seized and sold as slaves, while many others drowned in the sea. Others, again, were burned alive as the ships in which they were traveling were engulfed by flame. In the end, all suffered, some by the sword, and some by captivity, and some by disease, until but a few remained of the many. I, too, chose the way of the sea, and I arrived in the famed city of Naples, the city whose kings were merciful. That's where Barbanel writes about Tisha B'Av in 1492 and the expulsion of Jews from Spain. And that traumatic event. Many Jews hoped when they come to other lands there would be more tolerance and more openness, but there were in some areas, okay? But in other areas, things were, you know, very quickly turned bad. Ironically, one of the countries that was initially very opening and welcoming to Jews was Poland. It was just there. And Poland was open to Jews, and it was only, a disastrous result. More Jews died from Poland than the other country in the Holocaust, but that's because there were more Jews in Poland than the other country. Of the 6 million Jews, 3 million from Poland were died. So half the population of the 6 million that died were from Poland. Jews of Poland represented 10% of the population before World War II. So I don't know what exactly the statistic is in America. We're now at 1%, 1.5%, 2%, maybe 10%, 10%. We drove through towns and villages, but they said more than half the population is Jewish. Now there's not a trace. The reason there's so many Jews there is because at first they were very welcoming and you know, very open to Jews. The Jews were constantly looking for places where to go and where they might have better results. When Martin Luther and the Protestant Reformation came onto the scene, okay, so first there was hope. And the hope was sprung because Martin Luther hoped that the Jews, that their disagreement with Christianity was only with papal Christianity, with the Catholic religion, but once they see what I want to do, they'll all be won over. So Luther wrote in 1523, okay, his pamphlet was entitled that Jesus Christ was born a Jew. Okay, he writes, if I had been a Jew and seen such idiots and blockheads ruling and teaching the Christian religion, I would sooner become a pig than a Christian. Okay, that's how Luther wrote. Okay, he said, why don't the Jews become Christians? Because the Christian religion is run by idiots. That was Luther's position. Okay, I would advise, therefore, and beg everybody to deal kindly with the Jews and to instruct them in the scriptures. In such a case, we can expect them to come over to us. If we use brute force and slander them, saying that they need the blood of Christians to get rid of their stench and who knows what other nonsense of that kind and treat them like dogs, what good can we expect of them? Finally, how can we expect them to improve if we forbid them to work among us and to have social interaction with us and force them into usury? If we wish to make them better, we must deal with them according to the law of the Pope. Not according to the law of the Pope, rather, but according to the law of Christian charity. We must receive them kindly and allow them to compete with us in earning a livelihood, so they may have a good reason to be with us and among us an opportunity to witness Christian life and doctrine. If some remain obstinate, okay, whatever. Not every one of us is a good Christian either. Some Jews won't win over, okay, so us are not so free to lead him either. That was Martin Luther hoping to win over Jews to his Reformation. Of course, when that didn't happen, so Martin Luther became violently anti-Jewish, violent, vicious. Okay, in 1542, okay, he published a new essay called "Concerning the Jews and Their Lies," and in it Luther asked Christians, "What do you do with this damned, rejected race of Jews?" The answer: first, their synagogues and churches should be set on fire. Whatever does not burn up should be covered or spread over with dirt, and no one may ever be able to see a cinder or stone of it. Secondly, their homes should likewise be broken down and destroyed, for they perpetrate the same things there that they do in their synagogues. Sometimes they dab at home. Thirdly, they should be deprived of their prayer books and the Talmud, which such idolatry, lies, cursing, and blasphemy are taught. Fourthly, their rabbis must be forbidden under threat of death to teach anyone. Fifthly, traveling privileges should be absolutely forbidden to Jews. Let them stay at home. Sixthly, they ought to be stopped from usury. All their cash and valuables of silver and gold ought to be taken from them and put aside for safekeeping. Seventhly, let the young and strong Jews and Jewesses be given the flail, the axe, the hoe, the spade, the spindle, let them earn their bread, as is enjoined upon Arab's children. If, however, we are afraid that they might harm us personally or our wives, children, servants, cattle, etc., when they serve us or work for us, then let us apply the same cleverness as the other nations, such as France, Spain, Bohemia, talking about expulsion, okay, and settle with them for that which they have extorted from us, and after having divided up fairly, let us drive them out of the country for all time. So he changed his mind, as we can see, and that became, you know, a position followed by his followers to one degree or another. I mentioned earlier the rise of nationalism, the Age of Enlightenment, the age of the new openness, at least allegedly, and it looked like things would be better for Jews. John Locke in England, okay, people who influenced the founding fathers in America, John Locke wrote in 1689, "There is no such thing as a Christian commonwealth. Neither pagan nor Muslim nor Jew ought to be excluded from civil rights of the commonwealth because of the religion." Frederick II, the King of Prussia, in 1740, writes, "All religions are equal and good, if only the people that practice them are honest people." Okay, and if people want to come live in this country, we would build. If heathens came and wanted to live in this country, we would build them mosques and churches. And in France's Declaration of the Rights of Man and Citizens, their Declaration of Independence, so to speak, or 1789, "Men are born and always continue free and equal in respect of their rights." So the Age of Enlightenment, and that's point. So that looked like it was a period that could certainly become something much more positive for Jews. Things didn't work out that way in the long run, as you've seen by now. In each case, you see it doesn't. Okay. In 1831, Edward Meyer, a German historian, wrote of a Jew who converted to Christianity. "Baptized or not, it's all the same. We don't hate the religion of the Jews, but the many hateful characteristics of these Asiatics. Okay, so that becomes a different race of different people. As a side point, I'm reminded of the story when the Jews ran away to Shanghai, or they went off to Mir Yeshiva, and others escaped to Shanghai. So the Japanese, if you recall, were allies of Germany. So there was a question, why should the Germans ally the Japanese to give the haven to the Jews? So two of the great leaders of the Jews who ended up in Shanghai at that time were Isaac Scheer, who was in Rosh Hashiva in Mir Yeshiva, and Amshon HaRebbe. So they were summoned before whatever Japanese thought leader explained, why should we help your people when, you know, our allies hate you so much? So Isaac Scheer, I looked back and I was nervous, and he was learning, he killed the whole time. Cheerful, and had a smile when they rode to, in the car, to, or wagon, or train, or whatever it was, to go see the Japanese official. And so when the Japanese official met them, so he asked them, tell me, well, let me understand, why do the Germans hate you so much? So the Amshon HaRebbe said, because we're Asians. Somehow that was enough, you know, to convince the religious alone. Anyway, but that's what this person wrote in 1831. We don't hate the religion of these Jews, but the many hateful characteristics of the Asiatics. Among them, their so frequent impudence and presumption. The Christian is right about that. Anyway, their immorality and frivolity, their noisy behavior, their so frequently based approach to life. They belong to no people. No, this is 1839, so it's 100 years before the Nazis. Okay? They belong to no people, no state, no community. They rove about the world as adventurers, sniffing around. And where they stay, they find lots of opportunities for speculation. When things go quiet in accordance with law, they find it uncomfortable. So again, you know, you get this notion of the Jews being different, the Jews being alien, the Jews not being part of society, the Jews being, you know, racially or more than socially, racially different. Now further to the east, Russia, we know that after the assassination in 1881 of the Tsar Alexander II, okay, you know, we know from Fiddler on the Roof what you know about the Tsar. I mean, God keep it all far away from us. However, when Alexander II was shot, there was a Jewish woman named Gesia Gelfand who was involved in the plot. Well, that's all it takes. We're back to Mordechai. That's all it takes. All it takes is one Jew who was involved to say that this is, all Jews. And so there were pogroms all over Europe. In Kiev, April 26, 1881. A witness described the rioting in Kiev. At 12 o'clock noon, the air echoed with wild shouts, whistling, jeering, hooting, and laughing. An enormous crowd of young boys, artisans, and laborers was marching. The entire street was jammed with the Barefoot Brigade. The destruction of Jewish homes began. Window panes and doors began to fly about. And shortly thereafter, the mob, having gained access to the houses and stores, began to throw upon the streets absolutely everything that fell into their hands. Clouds of feathers began to whirl in the air. The sound of broken window panes and frames, the crying, shouting, and despair on the one hand, and the terrible yelling and jeering on the other completed the picture. Shortly afterwards, the mob threw itself upon the Jewish synagogue, which, despite its strong bars, locks, and shutters, was wrecked in a moment. One should have seen the fury with which the riffraff fell upon the Torah scrolls, of which there are many in the synagogues. The scrolls were torn to shreds, trampled in the dirt, and destroyed with incredible passion. This was in Russia, again, blaming Jews for something that happened that they really had no more to do with than anybody else. There was interest at that time among Jews. The Jews did not feel safe where they lived, okay, in whatever town, because there were always these pogroms, which were always a possibility in Russia. Or expulsion. There was interest in suddenly in Zionism and Jews moving to Eretz Yisrael, not necessarily among the from, even among the non-religious, because it appeared to be a safe haven for Jews. Okay, and here's a description again of the 1880s in Minsk. The Jews of Minsk prepared for battle. Their homes became fortresses. Nobody felt safe, even in his own house. The Christian servants looked as funny now and so on. Built in Potomac, building barricades. Again, I don't want to take the time to read but there are many other of these. I think of these dramatic and sharp quotes. One is the following, written by Moshe Leib Lilienblum, who was an influential Jewish writer of the time. There was a Rehov Lilienblum in a few cities in Eretz Yisrael. That's him. Okay. He wrote about what became one of the first calls for Jews to establish a homeland in Eretz Yisrael. One should collect and assemble the data about those Jewish activities which harm the natives. We then are not natives. That's what I said at the Rumsfeld. We're not natives. what they write about us, interference with the Jews and the natives. So obviously we're not natives. So we're not natives. During the pogroms, a native woman, ragged and drunk, danced in the streets, joyously shouting, "This is our country, this is our country." Can we say the same, even without dancing in the street, without being drunk? Yes, we are aliens not only here, but in all of Europe, for it is not our fatherland. Now I understand the word anti-Semitism. This is the secret of our affliction and exile. Even in Alexandria, Egypt, at the time of the Second Temple, and in all the lands of our dispersion, we touched upon it, we were aliens, unwanted guests. We were aliens in Europe, where religion flourished because of our religion. Now when nationalism reigns, we are aliens because of our origin. No, very sharp. We were aliens because of our religion, when religion was important. Now that religion is not so important, we're aliens because we're not, you know, we don't have the same nationality, so to speak. Our future is fearful, without a spark or hope or a ray of light. Slaves, aliens, strangers forever. Yet why should we be aliens in alien countries if the land of our fathers has not yet been forgotten and remains vacant? It can absorb our people. We must cease to be aliens and return to our fatherland. We must buy land there little by little, becoming rooted there like other people live in the land of their fathers. We are being uprooted from the land of our residence. The gates are open for us to leave. We are, in fact, fleeing. Why then flee to America and be alien there, too, instead of to the land of our fathers? That's what the Lord moved about. Well, what about in America? Well, Jews generally had a good life in America. Moshe Feinstein, the Chuvah, refers to it as the Medina Sochesed, talks about the importance of voting and so on and so forth. But it's not that everything was perfect all the time in America either. And it is noteworthy that, you know, in Russia, they produced a document known as the Protocol of the Elders of Zion, or heard of it, which is a list, or it's a detailed, completely fabricated. It was shown to be fabricated. A completely fabricated presentation of Jews who meet secretly to control things in the world, take over businesses, and so on. And this was very popular. People didn't like Jews to begin with. So the Protocol of the Elders of Zion had its, you know, had, so to speak, its desired effect. And it was a document that, you know, it's a heinous document. But nonetheless, the you know, for example, even in World War I, okay, Jews were suspected of spying whichever side you weren't on. Okay, the assumption was that every Jew was a spy. The Russian government began expelling Jews from towns close to the battlefront. This is in World War I. And again, the protocol is designed, even the United States caught on, and it was most, perhaps, I don't say most, but certainly very much popularized and believed in by Henry Ford. Okay, Henry Ford, you know, founded the Ford Motor Company and so on. Now, back in August of 1921, the New York Times exposed the protocols as a fraud, and they showed how the original author of the document copied fictional works from other places and put together from earlier things and so on and so forth. And all of this was shown to be, and a reputable publishing company in the United States stopped publishing it, a publishing company called Iron Spottersburg. They stopped publishing the protocols after the expose by the Times. But, you know, even without desktop publishing, without a computer, someone else could publish it, and it continued to be published. Okay, Henry Ford was one of the strongest supporters. In 1919, he published his own newspaper in Michigan called the Dearborn Independent. And, you know, he was given the protocols, he bought into it, and he had articles like "The Scope of Jewish Dictatorship in the United States," "Jewish Degradation of American Baseball," "The International Jew, the World's Foremost Problem." And in 1922, he turned those articles into a book that sold more than 500,000 copies, a lot at that time. Many Jews tried to show Ford that, you know, that he was wrong, that he was misunderstood, and so on and so forth, and he was not swayed. Eventually, in 1924, the newspaper ran a series of articles attacking a general by the name of Aaron Shapiro, a Chicago attorney, okay, and Ford accused Shapiro of being part of a conspiracy of Jewish bankers who seek to control the food market of the world. Okay, which is in line with what it says in the protocol. And it's here in the United States. Well, here in the United States, and you sue, okay, so you count to sue and so on. So forth. I mean, when you're attacked, you sue. So Shapiro understood that. So he sued Henry Ford. There was a whole case, and it was a mistrial, and Jewish government officials got involved, and eventually Ford, you know, backed away. He dropped it as anti-Semitic campaign. Nonetheless, the damage was done. Of course, we don't need to document here. We'll talk about it in other years, which is in the past. The Nazis, things came to an unprecedented level, especially in terms of racial anti-Semitism, and the destruction of the Jews was absolutely unprecedented. It's difficult to say Poland can return for 49 days. So this is the fifth time I've been in the last 2 years. And my response always is, the more you see it, the less you believe it happened. I mean, the more you see, the more you take in, the less you can believe that it could possibly have happened.
No, the Holocaust.
You know, it's so mind-boggling. It's so staggering. When you see the efficiency in which things are carried out, and, you know, it's just, I don't know how to say it, other than it's just, you know, people have normalized, all of a sudden everything changed. I mentioned this morning, I'll digress for a second, the very first kinnah this morning starts with the word Shabbat, which means, you know, everything stopped. Time came to a standstill. In Auschwitz, Auschwitz is mostly barracks. Auschwitz started out, the camp has two parts, really three parts, the two parts we go. But Auschwitz is the stone barracks. That's where the Mount Sinai is, and that's where it was originally built as a military establishment. Okay? So they have different rooms, they have different exhibits in it. So there's one exhibit which is put together by Yad Vashem. I found it personally very moving, very striking. You walk into the room, it's a dark room, and on the wall you begin to see flashes of different pictures. Think of the name of a country. So it says, the Netherlands. And you see a picture of a Jewish family on vacation. And over here is a picture of a shul. Here's a picture of people on the street. Here's a picture of different pictures keep lighting up the wall. And then it says Germany. And then you see also people on the top of the streets, people at a tavern, religious Jews, not religious Jews, and then that shows up and says the next country, whatever it is, the Belgium, and so on and so forth. We see all these pictures on the wall, which are all pictures of ordinary life. That's what it is. Ordinary daily life, religious life, and secular life, and social life, and economic life. People, family pictures, family portraits, and so on. And then in one shot, the room goes completely dark. Everything disappears. And it stays like that for a few moments. And the idea is that's what happened. You had life, normal life, and all of a sudden, like that, it's gone, disappeared in a matter of moments. And most people who were killed at Auschwitz, most of the Jews who were killed in Auschwitz, most Hungarian Jews who were killed in Auschwitz, was towards the very end of the war. The war was almost over at that time. You know, it's just, it's so hard to you know, to imagine in many, many ways. And in the early days in Germany itself, here was a, when you know, the Germans began to boycott and not go to Jewish businesses and so on and so forth, okay? There's a right, Edwin Landau, a veteran of World War I, who had military medals fighting for Germany, okay? He realized the following. The land and this people that until now I had loved and treasured had suddenly become my enemy. So I was not a German anymore, nor was I supposed to be one. And that, of course, cannot be settled in a few hours. But one thing I felt immediately is I was ashamed that I had once belonged to these people. That was his reaction. So an important comment. So in terms of the in terms of the Holocaust, as I said, it's got to be looked at its own, it's a detail by itself in terms of the scope. But many of the things which we touched upon today were the background. So what Hitler wrote about, not just racism, the Jews are different, they're alien, you know, all these things that play a role in the Holocaust as well. I do want to mention the following. There were people, you know, lest we think, I mean, that not everybody is anti-Semite. And I just want to read to you from the writings of an American writer who was a war correspondent who came to the camp outside Ordos. He described what he saw. We drove through the gate and halted. A circle of dead men lay there in striped slave uniforms, which we now saw for the first time. These cadavers were fleshless. In back of each tight-skinned shaven skull was a bullet hole. A pole opened the door of a shed. There was a cordwood stack of stiff, naked human bodies, a stack as high as we stood. The bodies were flat and yellow as lumber. The yellow disinfectant was scattered over the pile. We had known, the world had vaguely heard, but until now none of us had looked on this. There's not often a meaning in being first and getting somewhere first so to rush out at the moment ahead of the others with the news. But today I somehow knew that I had to find and experience this without anyone telling me what it would be like. This was part of my personal quest. This was a source of fear and guilt in every human who remained alive. For human beings had it in them to do this, and we were of the same species. And a few days later, General Eisenhower described his response. I visited every nook and cranny of the camp because I felt it my duty to be in a position from then on to testify firsthand about these things in case there ever, speak of prophecy, in case that ever grew up at home the belief or the assumption that the stories of Nazi brutality were just propaganda. But Eisenhower foresaw the possibility of Holocaust denial, and he said he wants to see everything so he knows it can't be. I not only did so, but as soon as I returned to General Patton's headquarters that evening, I sent communications to both Washington and London, urging the two governments to send instantly to Germany a random group of newspaper editors and representative groups from the national legislature. I felt that the evidence should be immediately placed before the American and British publics in a fashion that would leave no room for cynical doubt. Well, Eisenhower did that, and there was cynical doubt. Anyway, we all know about Holocaust denial, which has become something today. Emil Fackenheim wrote of a 614th commandment, a commanding voice from Auschwitz. What is the voice of Auschwitz command? Jews are forbidden to hand Hitler posthumous victories. They are commanded to survive as Jews, lest the Jewish people perish. They are commanded to remember the victims of Auschwitz, lest their memory perish. They are forbidden to despair of man and his world, to escape and through the cynicism of otherworldliness, lest they cooperate in delivering the world over to the force of Auschwitz. Finally, they are forbidden to despair of the God of Israel, lest Judaism perish. In modern times, of course, Eretz Yisrael is the focal point. Okay, we know that there are various forms of anti-Semitism today around it, surround that. There was high hopes in the early part of the 1900s. I think we spoke about that one year. The intellectuals among the Muslims and so on wanted to work. Met with Chaim Weizmann. Okay, one of the Arab leaders at the time. Hussein bin Ali, a descendant of the original Prophet Muhammad, their Prophet Muhammad, and a head of the Arab clan that guarded Islamist holy shrines in Mecca and Medina. He speaks about here a meeting with Weizmann, and he said there's room for both of us in this land to cooperate with each other. People less informed and less responsible, my leaders and yours, ignoring the need for cooperation of the Arabs and Zionists and trying to exploit the local difficulties that might necessarily arise in the early stages. Okay, I wish to give you my firm conviction that all these differences are not questions of principles, but are matters of details. I look forward, and my people with me look forward, to a future in which we will help you and you will help us, that the countries in which we are mutually interested may once again take their place in the community of civilized peoples of the world. We know he was in the minority. Okay, Haji Amin al-Husseini, the Mufti of Jerusalem, was a vicious, violent anti-Semite, met with Hitler, supported Hitler, and so on. And again, moving ahead, even past that, 1975, United Nations vote that racism, Zionism, a form of racism. In 2001, the Durban Conference. Okay, people don't really remember it that well because it was only a few days before 9/11. It made it in the news at the time, but September 11th overshadowed it. But in Durban, in South Africa, there's a United Nations Committee on racism and so on. So a lot of stuff there was printed. It was terrible, in terms of the Jews. And Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, then the chief rabbi of Great Britain, wrote that he said that he's among those who believe that widespread anti-Semitism no longer threatened Jews. That's what he wrote in the late 1990s. But after that conference, he explained he changed his mind because of what happened there and because of, there's this tremendous, in one of the sessions, somebody else described, the protesters stormed the tent and screamed in their lungs, "You're all murderers, you have Palestinian blood on your hands." They approached us as we gathered at the center of the room around the table where the panelists were seated. Panic drives some people to run away. "You don't belong to the human race. Chosen people, you're the cursed people. I wouldn't even speak to you as long as you remove this thing," and then yells at somebody who was wearing a yarmulke and so on. The talk continues. "Why haven't the Jews taken responsibility for killing Jesus? They've sucked our blood all these years. We don't want you here. Jews don't belong in Jordan. Jews don't belong in Israel. I believe in the Jewish state on Mars. Ariel Sharon, Israeli Prime Minister, Golda Meir, they're all the same. We cannot convince Sharon as a human being. The anger against us can no longer be contained. We have no refuge. The violence has to become physical." Again, it's just a couple of days later was the September 11th attack. So this did not get quite the publicity that it might have. But we have today the borders like the BDS, careless statements. Okay, and I know that it seems that, everyone's always accusing everybody else of being racist and so on, but somehow, when the comments about Jews, that people look the other way. People, "Oh, that's okay. If you say it about Jews, no one's going to get offended, we'll get offended instead of anybody else. But substitute the word Jew, and it doesn't carry the same clout. I don't want to comment now on you know what's going on in the southern border with potential refugees, but I can tell you that having been in Auschwitz a few weeks ago, I did not see any similarities between Auschwitz and the or any of the other concentration camps and what's going on over there. And statements that conjure up that kind of thing, I think, are very much misplaced. I'll just conclude. We can conclude on a positive note, on a negative note. In 1927, Sigmund Freud, which was, wrote, "With regard to anti-Semitism, I don't really want to search for explanation. I feel a strong inclination to surrender my ethics in this matter and find myself confirmed in my wholly non-scientific belief that mankind on the average and taken by and large are a wretched lot." And that wasn't psychoanalytical or anything like that, but that was, you know. On the other hand, Jean-Paul Sartre, famous philosopher, wrote a book I have here called Anti-Semite Jew. This is a poet I read in 1946 or something. Now, he writes at the end of the work, he writes as follows. He talks about anti-Semitism, but he begins with a quote from Richard Wright, who I was not previously familiar, a Negro writer, black writer, and person by the way to refer to him. "There is no Negro problem in the United States, there's only a white problem. In the same way, you must say that anti-Semitism is not a Jewish problem, it is our problem." It starts about Jewish problem. Okay? It is our problem. "Since we are not guilty yet run the risk of being its victim, yes, we too must be very blind indeed not to see that it is our concern in the highest degree. It is not up to the Jews, first of all, to form a militant league against anti-Semitism. It is up to us." Okay, and he writes that in order to awaken this passion, what is needed is not an appeal to the generosity of the Aryans, but even the best of them, that virtue is in eclipse. What must be done is to point out to each one that the fate of the Jews is his fate. Not one Frenchman will be free so long as the Jews do not enjoy the fullness of their rights. Not one Frenchman will be secure so long as a single Jew in France or the world at large can fear for his life." And you can put in the names of other people as well. That's a kind of a more positive point. I just want to finish. Soloveitchik, in analyzing the Purim story, which was certainly, you know, in Tanakh, really the first story of our desire to exterminate the Jews. So Soloveitchik wrote, and this is found in Reflections of the Rav, Volume 1, starting on page, a whole chapter, but I'll just mention, he said there are four lessons that we can learn from the Purim story. First lesson, man can become Satan. Okay? Our faith in man's goodness should not blind us to latent demonic in man. That's what Freud said. We're a wretched lot, I didn't quote Freud, but that's what he said. The fact that Haman was able to to do that and get other people to win, that's one thing. Second lesson, the Jew is more vulnerable than others. Human monsters, the Rav writes, though an enemy and threat to all mankind, somehow specialize in the hatred of the Jew. They may be proponents of a particular ideology of the left or of the right, agnostic secularists or rational clericalists, yet they strangely become preoccupied with the Jew and derive particular delight from tormenting him. This hatred of the Jew emerges from any economic or political spectrum. Okay, so that's the second lesson. The Jew is more vulnerable to others. The third lesson, all Jews share a common destiny. Shouldn't think, well, it can't happen here in Soviet. Hatred of the Jew is an animosity directed against the entire group. It is not necessarily confined to religious or ethnically conscious Jews or more conspicuous by their separateness. The hatred of Haman is commodious enough to embrace the Jew with the mezuzah on his doorpost, as well as the Jew whose home is devoid of all symbols of Jewishness. The distinctive garb and striking appearance of the chassid did not make him any more likely a victim of the Nazis than westernized Jews who are outwardly indistinguishable from non-Jews. The assimilated and the national Jew evoked the same venom from the tyrant. Finally, fourth lesson, God does not abandon his people. Tov kol sof, paradoxically perhaps, and even if Freud is right, that human beings are by nature a wretched lot, nonetheless, somehow, Kadosh Baruch Hu protects us, saves us, sometimes at a great great cost and after great suffering and so on. But Tov Kol Sof, that's the Ani Mamin, that we await Kadosh Baruch Hu, we wait for our Father, so to speak, to wake up, as I mentioned before last night, and we understand that the time will come, and ultimately the final triumph over anti-Semitism will be Kadosh Baruch Hu's, and will be ours as well.